If you believe that civic engagement is crucial for helping to make community a healthier, happier, and more vibrant place to live, please join us. Become a member of City Club at cityclubofeugene.org. The program today is sponsored by the Oregon Country Fair. The Oregon Country Fair creates events and experiences that can nourish the spirit, explore living artfully and authentically on earth, and transform the culture in a magical, joyous, and healthy ways. Let's jump to the program, the Glenwood Refinement Plan, coordinated by Randy Prince, who will introduce the program.
Thank you. Today's program looks at changes coming for Glenwood and the public process that developed the planning for that neighborhood. Over the last 30 years, citizen and staff from both the City of Eugene and Springfield wrote and updated an award-winning refinement plan and formed an urban renewal district that permits funding of improvements. A refinement plan is a set of fairly detailed planning guidelines for a specific area within a city or metropolitan area. The basic zoning map and rules are described in the metro plan and city code, and like those documents, the refinement plan has some legal force. Citizens from the area in question participate in making up the detailed plan, and professionals on a city's staff translate their wishes into technically correct language. The Glenwood Refinement Plan was begun in the 1980s, just a few years after Eugene Springfield adopted its metro plan, and many, but not all, Eugene neighborhoods went through this process back then. In recent years, there's been less use of this planning approach, but the plans that were finished then remain in force. In the late 1990s, Glenwood residents asked to be placed under the jurisdiction of Springfield city government, and the planning and updating has continued under that city's guidance. Now, the choice of this program today was prompted by a recent breakdown in planning for changes in the South Willamette area of Eugene. Our mayor declared a reset in the process due to a loss of trust between some neighbors and city staff. A couple of city councilors have now proposed writing a refinement plan. Other people say it's too cumbersome and time-consuming. And the City Council will hear opinions from the public on September 19th. We hope that today's program will inform our audience here and on the radio about what approaches might be best for planning the way our metro area will look in the future. Both cities will need to meet goals of designing an urban landscape that's compact, walkable, oriented to transit corridors, and minimizes the pressure to expand outward. The disputed area in South Eugene is just likely to be just one of the first where important planning changes will be proposed, and the question is how to involve citizens in these updates. We have three speakers today, Steve Moe, Courtney Griesel, and Barry Summer. I'll tell you a little bit more just before each one speaks. Before that, I want to point out that on our City Club website, we will be posting a YouTube video describing the award one that the Glenwood Refinement Plan won from the American Planning Association in 2015. First up is Steve Moe. He grew up in Glenwood and operates an electronic business there. He was part of this process that established our metro plan back in the 80s, the Glenwood Refinement Plan, and both of Springfield's urban renewal districts. And he currently serves on the Springfield Planning Commission. He's not a city staffer, he's a citizen. Come on up, Steve.
Thank you, Randy. Get this up here. I don't have a voice. A week ago today, most of you know I run on Mount Pisgah trails. A week ago today, at this time, I went up and I blacked out and ended up emergency in McKenzie Willamette, and I have a pulmonary embolism and took 3 days. So that's my voice is gone, and so but I'm okay now, but a little nervous. Glenwood Refinement Plan, overview of the process. In 1973, Oregon passed what is often called Senate Bill 100. It set up statewide mandate for land use and planning. It said that local communities are required to come up with local land use plans for their area. Lane County and the Metropolitan Area Planning Advisory Committee was formed to develop what was our first metro plan. And it was originally a Eugene Springfield Lane County one only plan. And it was adopted in 1980. I was a member of the original MAPAC. We spent a couple of years formatting a document that was already in the process in the Portland area, but not adopted by any city in Oregon at that time. We had no idea what we were doing. We were given lots of direction by staff, and away we went. Lots and lots of hot meetings at the Lane County Courthouse. The original MAPAC group stood in front of a local area map and actually drew the borders, of everything that would be in the urban growth boundary. We really didn't understand the power or the possible impact of our results, but we were dedicated to producing the best plan, and we did a fantastic job. Those original boundaries have been modified over the years, but essentially remain similar. I want you to know that if you like those boundaries, those are the ones I drew. If you don't like some of those boundaries, Sandra Bishop did those. After the Metro Plan was accepted by all three jurisdictions, areas were designated for further refinement. And refinement plans began to be developed for those areas. Sorry, I'm not close enough to the microphone. Glenwood was one of those areas. At that time, Glenwood was in the Eugene jurisdiction, and City of Eugene staff put together a citizen group to meet every other week for a couple of years. The citizen group was given almost complete freedom and openly listened to residents, landowners, and businesses. Each area in Glenwood, each little area, was examined, discussed, and we tried our best to come up with a plan that best represented what already existed and what we felt would be the best future. City of Eugene staff was fantastic. They didn't tell us what they wanted. They listened to the wants of Glenwood citizens and let us make the plan. That's key. The plan was adopted. In 1998, in response to Glenwood citizens' request, Glenwood was transferred to Springfield's jurisdiction, and Springfield formed a new citizens team to modify the Eugene version of the refinement plan and make it up to date. The Springfield vision of the refinement plan was adopted in 2005, similar to the original Eugene plan, but updated. We became aware that even the 2005 plan wasn't to the standards that would encourage real healthy growth, so we set on a new update and targeted the area between Franklin Boulevard and the river. It's an area that is undeveloped, underdeveloped, and few residents to impact. The newest plan was completed in 2013 and was approved by all government entities and sent forward. However, in this last part of the process, one landowner was not happy with the results and appealed to LUBA. It took a couple more years to get adoption. It was an example of the community and city going through meetings, open doors, open houses, knocking on doors, and attempting to contact everyone who would be impacted. Then one person comes in at the last meeting and said, "I don't know anything about this." We've seen that. Normally, it's too late at that stage, but this particular landowner had the resources to appeal to LUBA, and he did. So it took a couple more years for that to get fixed. Now that existing plan is adopted and in place. Many times, there are always those who don't agree or haven't paid attention. Then rumors are generated and become the truth. There is incredible fear that the city is out to redevelop Glenwood and displace the mobile home parks and low-income residents. I'm a Glenwood resident and particularly sensitive to those possibilities. In all the committees I've been on, including being on the Springfield Planning Commission, I never heard of talk or making plans that go in that direction, and usually it's intense discussion of how to protect those people. Those people are important, and we do care, and particularly myself. Mobile home parks have the most to fear, as most residents have no alternative. We understand, and many groups are working on ways to have dignified and low-cost solutions. I'm personally working for and support those groups. I've been involved in community land use planning for many years. The one thing I find consistent is all plans take years to implement, and I mean 10 to 20 years. The mobile home parks are privately owned, and only the owners can make decisions. The parks are low-income people, but generate a lot of income for the owners. That, along with the political turmoil closing a park down would create, make it highly unlikely that any will close for, in my feeling, 20 years. It's a long ways out there. Plans are visions of our future, but when printed in the media, people think it's going to happen tomorrow. Plans are only on paper. They are long range. They can be and often are changed to fit changing conditions and community standards. The Glenwood Refinement Plan has been updated 4 times. Each time, it was a committee of Glenwood residents, property owners, and businesses that studied the existing plan and make recommendations of what they felt would make a better community. with great communication with city staff, both in the Eugene period and the Springfield period, most of those recommendations have been incorporated in the future plan. Staff has always respected what we told them, and we are grateful. Great communication and cooperation has been the key and builds trust between the citizens and the city. The real key is the communication part. It's difficult to get everybody to hear the facts, and from that we get fear. Fear turns into rumors and then becomes fact. When the media takes those facts, and I know they don't try to be biased, but they make good news, prints or broadcasts them, people only see the bad facts, and it's an uphill struggle. Communication with the citizens is the most important thing to do. Everyone has important things to do, but we still have the responsibility to be informed and aware of what's going on ourselves. Most people don't do that. Our city clubs are an example of what we're trying to do to help get that out to people. I'm done. Thank you.
Our second speaker is Courtney Griesel. She is the Community Development Manager for the City of Springfield. She's a graduate of the U of O's School of Planning, Public Policy, and Management, and has a master's degree in organizational leadership from Gonzaga University. Courtney?
Thanks for having us today. We're excited to talk about Glenwood. I'll admit that being on the economic development side of things, this plan really doesn't actually take place without citizen vision, our planners, our elected officials, and the economic lens. And I think that that's actually why we feel that we have created a successful plan. It really is influenced by all of these key pieces. For us, it started back in 1999 when the jurisdictional transfer became a reality for us, and we then had a responsibility to the citizens of Glenwood. And what we understood was we needed to look at the vision that had been set forth. We needed to respect that and acknowledge it and improve upon it. But we also needed to put into place the tools that would actually let us implement the vision. And so for us, that was urban renewal. The urban renewal district in Springfield has to be voter approved, which is unique to our community. It helps us get a clear indicator from our citizens that they are aligned with us, that we're not proposing something they're not ready to do. So for Glenwood in 2004, that urban renewal district was passed with a majority vote. And that was a huge feat for us. That said, you know, we're ready. We've had the conversation. We have had citizens championing that urban renewal district formation. And we also have the resources and tools in place to move forward with the planning efforts to make something happen. We went through some processes of starting to use the existing refinement plan and engaging the development community. And people were very excited about what we were talking about. We were trying to focus on those underutilized areas. So not the areas that were already densely populated with residential homes or even industrial uses, but some of that open land that didn't have access, it didn't have infrastructure, it hadn't really been thought through or planned for. And what we were hearing from the development community was your refinement plan isn't enough. It gives us a general vision of today without the certainty for how it actually looks tomorrow. So if I make this investment in this property here today, there's no certainty for me that the neighboring property will develop in a way that is beneficial to my investment or to my value. So we suddenly realized that while we had some tools, we had some plans, we had some general awareness of the community's vision for today, we hadn't really balanced that yet with the goals of the property owners in some areas, or the financial feasibility that was necessary for a developer to come in, or even from a local property owner to come in and make an investment. So we took another run at the plan. And we scaled all the way back. And we said it's time to really start from the ground level, re-engage the community, engage them at a larger level. So we talk with the local residents, the local property owners, business leaders, but also larger regional stakeholders. and folks who are leaders in feasibility of planning and how that actually pencils on the ground. For us, it was a six-year process, and Steve calls part of that being because of the process for land use adoption, which allows for appeals. It's a fair and transparent and lengthy process, and it's one of those things we just expect it. But for us, there was nine of us staff members in a room every week going through public comments that we had received or organizing community meetings. In total, we had almost 60 community public meetings over about 2.5 years, which was really the intense visioning and the intense review. It was a lot of work. It was very exciting. It's not entirely normal for communities to write refinement plans entirely in-house with in-house staff. We acknowledged that going in, and we looked at our citizens and prepared them. We told our citizen advisory committee, this is going to be a big lift. You're going to be very busy for a couple years, and we need you to be busy and engaged. And they were. We had a technical advisory committee as well that met not as often as the citizens or the staff meeting, but multiple times a month, looking at code, which was the other important element for us. It couldn't just be a refinement plan, a planning document. It also had to include the alignment with our actual code so that the land use lined up with a development review. If someone came in that the interpretation of how their development would be reviewed would still conform with that bigger vision. So we were looking at things like facades and where infrastructure would go and how that would feel to the neighboring residents, both the existing and the future. For all those reasons, for all of that engagement, as we started doing the cost benefit of what it was we were asking the citizens to do, we found ourselves being recognized as kind of leading in the effort. That's where the APA award came about in 2015. We put our planning process and plan through a lens of understanding what does this really cost the community? What does this do to the citizen property value? What does it do to the future? What does it do today? And ultimately, it's been very exciting. It's been very effective. We have two phases. They're both along the riverfront. We have not yet moved into the core of Glenwood. And part of that is because that is an established residential neighborhood. And we've heard early that that is the vision for that core. At the moment, there's not necessarily been a demand from the citizens that they want us to start looking at refining that planning area. But we do acknowledge that with that refinement, we start to get certainty on where infrastructure goes, where do pipes go, how do we increase our ability to handle different modes, biking and walking, very important things. So those things will come into the future. But at this point, we're excited that we have a roadmap. We have a roadmap that has citizen buy-in and the vision. There's still some need to be flexible with certain elements because when it actually comes to development hitting the road or citizens wanting to make improvements or properties making improvements, there will be questions about meeting the intent, but not necessarily down to the letter of the code. So we look at those things with flexibility and with a lens to really partner.
Thank you, Courtney. Our third speaker is Barry Summer. He is a 7-year resident of the Riverbank RV Park in Glenwood. Originally from California, he worked 10 years up here as an on-air personality in commercial and public radio in Eugene, Springfield. He recently went back to school, got his degree in history and philosophy at Northwest Christian College. I think you'll enjoy what he has to say. He is fairly well known for radio listeners, but his park is also known. One of a couple movies that have been shot in part in Glenwood was filmed there because a certain famous runner from the University of Oregon once lived there. Barry?
Thanks very much, everybody. I really appreciate being here. This is my first time at the City Club, my first time speaking. So I don't get nervous. I've spoken in front of groups before, so you won't see me melt into a little puddle somewhere. I'm sure you now know that the famous runner Randy was mentioning is Prefontaine. As a matter of fact, in the park I live in, on the riverbank, there is a little sort of a patio platform kind of thing, and it's where Prefontaine used to stop and take a break when he was running, and it's where they shot the movie. So we think that's kind of cool that we have a little spot there that has some Eugene history to it. I've lived in that whole neighborhood, the Glenwood neighborhood, Springfield, actually Mill Street, so right around there, for about 15 years now. And I chose to live in Riverbank RV Park because I wanted to live simply, and I wanted to live cheaply. You can do that. The concerns that I have and the concerns that my neighbors have been spoken on by Steve and by Courtney. I want to try to give you a little perspective from those of us who actually live in a trailer park. Now, Steve, I don't know if you live in a house or a trailer, but I assume a house, probably. Let me give you some dry numbers, just so you know. Lane County has the largest number of RV parks in Oregon. We have over 100 with 4,000 spaces. Lane County only. Most of those are here in Eugene and Springfield. State of Oregon has over 1,000 RV parks, more than any other state in the country, and 65,000 spaces. We're talking a lot of people here. We're not talking small numbers. For those of us on a fixed income, and I'm betting that some of you here are probably on a fixed income like me, so I collect Social Security. Those of us on a fixed income have to make some hard choices about where we want to live. I choose to do it because I want to live simply. Other people do it because there's no other choices. With that in mind, I want to address Courtney's point and Steve's point when they're talking about affordable housing. The average cost of an RV space in Glenwood is $300 a month. Average cost. Some a little higher, some a little lower. Average. Once those RV parks are gone, make no mistake, those RV parks are going to be gone. Steve, I'm going to take issue with your claim about 20 years, okay? It's not going to be 20 years, a lot sooner than that. I know from talking to my neighbors, talking to some of the other park owners, real estate developers are already scouting about. I'm going to call them land sharks. They're already moving about, and they're talking to the owners, and they're starting to make plans. These land sharks would not be making plans unless they saw the development going ahead and the ability for them to make some money. I'm not saying money's bad, but I think it's important to know that that's the reason why developers buy property. The park that I live in, Riverbank RV Park, there's already a developer talking to the owner of the property. The owner of the property has already said, if he makes me a correct offer, I'm going to sell. It doesn't matter from that standpoint how long the city's going to take to do this Glenwood redevelopment. Once all the land sharks get a hold of that property and kick everybody out and close it down, then what? Then there's no recourse. Then there's no direction that we can go as residents there because we're not there anymore. We're gone, but the Glenwood redevelopment is still 10 years down the road, 12 years, 15 years down the road. So please don't buy into when the city tells you, oh, we're not going to kick you out. We have no plans to do that. That's exactly what is going to happen. Cities don't want RV parks. They don't want trailer parks. You know why? What's the perception of who lives in trailer parks? You all know what that perception is, okay? But that is not true. But as long as that perception is perpetuated, we have, as residents of these RV parks, a very difficult time trying to get past that and get people to listen and understand, okay? Affordable housing. I've studied the Glenwood refinement plan, which I'm sure most of you have. The concept of affordable housing, great idea. As my dad says, everything looks good on paper. What's affordable housing? What is the concept that most people have about what affordable housing is? Rents here in Eugene are outrageous. How many people on a fixed income can afford to move into an average-priced one-bedroom apartment, which is about $850 a month? Few of us can. That's why that $300 a month space rent at an RV park allows us to be able to live comfortably and live safely. Affordable housing, Really? Okay. So we're paying an average of $300 a month. Low-income housing is built in Glenwood. Let's just assume that. Is that low-income housing going to be $300 a month to be able to allow us to be able to move from the RV park into this affordable housing? Of course not. Where do we go? Oh, I've heard some people mention, well, wait a minute, if you're on fixed income and you can't afford the rent, why don't you just get on Section 8 housing? 4-year waiting list for Section 8 housing, ladies and gentlemen. 4 years. What are we going to do for that period of time? Where do we go? A lot of people also have rigs that cannot be moved. Now, granted, the state will pay single wide $3,000, double wide $6,000, triple wide $9,000. But that doesn't solve the immediate problem of where do you then go? If the parks are being closed, less space for us to rent to and more competition for the few that would allow us. So where do the rest of us go? Do we park out in West Eugene in the industrial area by what used to be Hynix? Do we park along Railroad Avenue off Chambers? Okay. Do we park in those areas that are dangerous, that don't have facilities, that actually serve to marginalize us? If there's affordable housing that is not affordable, who's responsible for that? Not us being on fixed income. The responsibility is on those who actually create this quote-unquote affordable housing. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what most of my neighbors are going to do. We've talked about this a lot. But what do? Where do we go? And we all just say, I guess we'll wait until the state or the county or the city decides for us. We can't do that. We cannot do that. There's approximately around 1,500 people, population in Glenwood, 1,500 people. There's approximately, if you take all of the RV parks, including the ones in Glenwood proper, because there's one or two along, I think there's one off Glenwood Boulevard, one that's just west of Brooklyn, plus all the ones on Franklin, you have about 600 spaces. 600 spaces, approximately. If you take two to a space, that's 1,200 people. Well, how many of those people are going to end up being homeless? How many of those people are end up having to go to the Eugene Mission? How many of those people are going to end up taking their rigs somewhere, like I said earlier, outside of the city in an industrial area just to be able to live? How many of those people may lose their jobs because they don't have an address anymore? It all, from my perspective, boils down to how is the city of Springfield going to deal with what they call affordable housing for those of us on fixed incomes and those of us living in the RV parks? That is my biggest concern. A couple other things, if I may. We all know about the Wildish property, right? Down on Franklin, huge, it's where they do training. Here's just one man's idea for that, just one man's idea. Take the Wildish property and turn it into, how can I phrase this? The place where all of the homeless can be taken care of, housed, social services, food, mental health services. The infrastructure is there. The buildings are there. Everything's there. It's a huge piece of property. It seems to me, as one man, that is a perfect place to take care of what we know is a problem, and that's the homeless, the drug addicts, and the mentally ill that are on the streets. I've always felt that that's brilliant. Okay, I think my time is up. I could stay here for a while, but thank you.
The first question will be asked by Mayor-elect Lucy Vinnis.
Good afternoon, and thank you. Thank you, all of you, for being here to hear this presentation. I found this presentation compelling. I think when whether we're talking about the South Willamette Rezone and the issues there, whether we're talking about Glenwood, that this question of how the city, in my case, the city of Eugene, can do a better job than other jurisdictions have done around maintaining affordable housing at multiple levels. We do want you know, the dollars are there for more expensive housing. How do we continue to provide not just the very low income housing, but the workforce housing? How can we do that, and what tools do we have available? And many of the things that we bump up against in any part of the community, when we talk about redevelopment, when we talk about renovating the infrastructure, we are automatically increasing the property value. And what measures can we set in place to assure that we're not marginalizing people and forcing them farther and farther out from the city? It doesn't meet our goals in terms of climate change. It doesn't meet our goals in terms of quality of life or fairness or equity. So the question I have for you, Courtney, is whether the city of Springfield has looked at some of the other mechanisms available, and particularly the legislature's decision to allow municipalities to use inclusionary zoning, and whether you've thought about that in some of the development that might come forward. And then following on Barry's comments about what other sorts of protections might be put in place over those transitional years to sort of protect those trailer parks.
I think your inclusionary zoning question is actually probably better suited for some of our planning staff that watches that. So I wouldn't want to necessarily comment on something that would be inaccurate. I know that from our standpoint generally, though, as a community, the urban renewal district being formed and outlining specifically resources to assist with improvements to infrastructure to serve the existing manufactured home parks, as well as incentivizing affordable housing, is important because it creates an actual financial tool to implement, you know, kind of visionary affordable housing policy. Some of the things that we found ourselves struggling with when it came to affordable housing and the manufactured home parks had less to do with the zoning and had more to do with the deferred maintenance of infrastructure serving the existing affordable housing stock. And so what we really needed to do was understand, where is the appropriate place for people to live, regardless of income, to some extent, marginalizing folks even further by putting affordable housing next to heavy industrial is problematic from a social justice perspective. But in addition to that, it was how do we appropriately fund our ability to invest in infrastructure so that when some of those septic systems begin to fail or we find ourselves with electrical issues causing fires, that we are able to respond quickly and get them on city services. Until recently, in a lot of the parks on McVeigh Franklin, we didn't even have that infrastructure in the road yet. It hadn't been placed in a location that could serve and make sure that folks had the ability to live safely in those areas. But we can respond at a later time with the inclusionary zoning if you'd like. I just don't want to speak out of turn.
Thank you. Now we'll break for a few minutes so that members can formulate your own questions for the speakers, and we'll return in about 5 minutes. Thank you very much.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport, 90.5, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1, KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the September 9th City Club program, the Glenwood Refinement Plan. Today's program is supported by our silver sponsors, Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics, bringing scholars and activists to Eugene to discuss critical topics in the tradition of Senator Morse. It is dedicated to Morse's vision of peace and justice through law and politics, and also by the AARP of Oregon, keeping Oregonians informed, engaged, and active. And thank you to our in-kind sponsor for providing office space, KPFF Consulting Engineers, partnering with the world's most thoughtful professionals to engineer extraordinary places. The City Club offers thanks to KLCC for airing City Club programs at 6:30 p.m. on Mondays, although I believe this week is going to be on Tuesdays, and for archiving podcasts on their website. We'd also like to thank the Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club events. We received two questions that I posed to the panel from Commissioner Bozovich concerning today's topic. And I'll ask them both and ask you to respond to them both. The first is, how does the county solid waste transfer station fit into the refinement plan? And the second is, how is the proposed floodplain limitations under FEMA flood insurance program going to impact the refinement plan?
So those are two tiny topics. So the first one is, it fits as a pre-existing use. The transfer station, I think almost if you were to maybe ask the county, the bigger question would be, how does that transfer station fit into the larger Lane County Waste Management Plan? So, you know, for us, we acknowledge that its location is right at the entry point to our community. It's a key location, it's visible. We also acknowledge, though, that uses like that can exist in important locations when the facility is a current facility and it's managed indoor and with design standards, which you could find in the Glenwood Refinement Plan that really mask what it is and what it's doing. What we also know is that current technology and waste management could allow that to actually occur. On the larger picture, though, of the Waste Management Plan, what we're starting to find out is that that facility could use some upgrades, it can use some changes, it will fit into the future waste management system very differently. And then really that'll be that could be a great City Club presentation from Lane County when they're ready to talk about it. But for that reason, we're a partner with Lane County in it, and we are confident in where we'll be long-term. FEMA. So that is a big issue for us. It's a big topic for us. It's a big topic for a lot of medium-sized cities, a lot of communities, just generally in Oregon. It will affect most downtowns along the Coast Range and the I-5 corridor along major rivers. This is something that I think every community member will want to pay attention to based on where you sit in approximation to any floodplain, because it will impact flood insurance rates from a single family home all the way up to commercial. So while we look at it from a Glenwood perspective, and we acknowledge that it changes some of the feasibility of any development on a river that's within a floodplain, we know that this is an impact at a statewide level, and that we have partners in the communication about where we want the federal government to be as our ally in it. And we are very optimistic with our elected officials that we do have some advocacy. So from our perspective, we keep charging forward. You know how things move. Steve talks about 20-year plans. We don't dare just stop and wait for someone to give us bad news. We keep pushing the vision, and we keep making investments, and we acknowledge that we make our voice known.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. It's nice to see so many Springfield people here today. I've enjoyed the programs that I've gone to over in Springfield. My question is, about 15 years ago, our own Van Landingham set up a committee and got a law passed in the state to provide for some protections for the people who had to move in mobile homes. Could you tell us how effective that has been? What protections did they put in, and how good are they? Are they really going to work?
I'll talk about just the facts of it and then let Barry kind of reflect on how it actually feels as a tenant. The law is in place to protect tenants. It requires a 365-day notice from the park owner to be provided to the tenants. It's not an incredibly long amount of time when it requires a move. It requires that the property, the tenant, be paid $3,000, $5,000, or $7,000 based on the size of the structure that they live in. But unfortunately, that structure can't be a recreational vehicle. It can't be a trailer RV. It really has to be the basic definition of a manufactured structure. And what we find is that we have a lot of structures out there with families living in them, and they're what we call hitch and tow. it's legitimate housing. They live there. That is their home, but this law doesn't cover them, and that's a huge problem. The park could also close because of an emergency issue, a health and safety issue, and that would eliminate that 365-day notice. So those are some of the, that was the element of the law that was placed in John Van Landingham's efforts about a decade ago. It also provides some tax incentives, and it eliminates the ability for the landlord to raise the rent on tenants during that period, to penalize them for leaving early, or to penalize them financially for abandoning a structure there. So there's some protections. There's not entirely enough. But I'll let Barry kind of talk about how that actually feels or affects them.
Thank you. Of all the spaces that are in all the RV parks in Glenwood, it's probably about, from what I know from talking to my friends and talking to some of the other managers, it's probably about two-thirds or maybe a little more of what would be called manufactured or mobile homes. And the rest of them are basically trailers, either tow behind or fifth wheels. The biggest concern that I'm hearing is that, okay, moving a mobile home, if the state's going to pay, and Courtney, I think it was $3,000, $6,000, and $9,000, I think. But anyway, a couple of $1,000 difference. Even that amount of money sometimes is not enough to be able to safely move a single wide that has been in position for 30 years, 40 years, in some cases 50 years. There are also trailers, older trailers, that have been turned into what some of you may have heard, a park model, which is where a trailer actually becomes a permanent part of the space. You jack it up, you take it off its wheels, you build a patio, you may add stuff or something like that to it to make it your home. Those are just as difficult to move as a mobile home. And Courtney is correct, that has to be addressed. Because a lot of us, I have a park model. For me to move my rig would be cost prohibitive. And if the state's not going to cover me because it's a trailer and not a mobile home, then you're right, Courtney. That absolutely has to be addressed so fewer people will become stressed and ultimately homeless by this. Real quickly, one of the people in our park, he's the last guy who has a actual single wide. It was placed there in 1955. You should see the inside. Carved wood, craftsmanship. I mean, it's actually gorgeous. The outside is kind of run down, but that place cannot be moved. It cannot be moved. It's a single wide. If the state only gives him $3,000, he's going to have a heck of a time finding something similar to that. And he's not the only one. So this is a big concern that we have to address.
Organizations, Ruth Stamler speaking. Organizations in such as St. Vincent de Paul recognize the problem of the sale of the land for mobile homes, and we've just finished buying up. St. Vincent has 5 mobile home tracts now, because we can see the future of homelessness and real struggle of low-income families. My question, though, it has to do with the structure of the city. I come from an area where we had citywide elections that change from citywide to district elections. And you have a neighborhoods association now that's really built up and done a lot together in Glenwood. And I'd hate to see it ignored with citywide structure. And I was wondering if you were promoting or working with Springfield to see that maybe we could have a different election system so that it would be districts and every neighborhood would be concerned with what's happening in their community. The community I came from that saw the change made a huge difference in the city as far as elections and as far as neighborhood associations. They really perked up, they really got busy, they really did things to improve their community. And there is a possibility maybe that we could work towards district elections in Springfield. Have you thought of that? And what's going to happen to your neighborhood group? Steve?
She was looking at you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I think you're the one that more or less organized it.
You know, I've heard pros and cons on both those, where you have citywide elections of councilors and districts, which we have right here, and then in Eugene where you vote your counselors in a certain area, and we sort of feel you get concentrated representation from areas that are just elected in that area, and the others are citywide, and you're and he's responsible to everybody in the city, though he's from a certain area. Now, as far as Glenwood is concerned, we have community meetings, but I tell you, people lose interest real fast when there's not some issue bringing them together. And one other thing we have in Glenwood, which makes it very difficult, the mobile home parks are all little communities. They don't know what's going on next to them. They don't communicate, they don't talk to each other. Everyone's almost like a little city, a little community. And they're great, but it's really hard for us to bring everybody together at once. You get represented once in a while, but they go away and then they're not represented. And I don't know what the answer is.
Maybe they'll learn.
Yeah, and I want to throw some history in here, you guys. I grew up in Glenwood. Franklin Boulevard used to be the Pacific Highway, and there used to be auto courts. People traveled and they'd camp. And then they started pulling trailers. Trailer parks started. Well, you look at flood pictures, and all the trailers are in Springfield parked along the streets. When the floods come, they'd hook onto them and haul them over there. So that's when they're mobile homes, real mobile homes. Well, now they're permanent, it's a different thing, but that's how all the mobile home parks came to be in Glenwood.
John DeLow, City Club member, and I had a crazy question here. My wife and I can commiserate with Mr. Summers here because we both basically live on our Social Security. But what would happen if the city bought these parks? I don't know. How much does anyone know how much it would cost to buy an example of a park? And then
I can speak for Riverbank. I can't speak for the other Shamrock or the others in Shamrock, I believe, is the biggest one along Franklin. What I have been told is that the property that I live on, Riverbank RV Park, which has 22 spaces, is worth approximately $750,000. Mm-hmm. Now you got to figure it's on the river, so it's going to have a higher value, okay? However, one of the problems for us as Riverbank is, and I don't know if this is the case for the other parks along Franklin, is that there is a clause that says once our park is sold, and I really appreciate St. Vinny's buying up these parks, okay, to take care of them. But our park, once it's sold, the new owners cannot operate it as an RV park. They are required by the sale to shut it down. The only thing they can do is they can shut it down, upgrade everything, which Courtney pointed out earlier, there are some problems with some of the infrastructure with electrical, plumbing, septic, things like that, that really should be upgraded. But that would cost, what, $1 million to upgrade it? And then are you going to have $275, $300 spaces? No. So there goes all of the people like you and I on fixed income.
Barry, what's the cost? What's the cost from?
The cost.
It's
a title clause, which to me I thought was very interesting. But then again, I think you would agree with me, most of those RV parks along Franklin are on septic systems. They're not hooked up to sewer. That's one reason why the city put in the main sewer along Springfield, was to get everybody to hook up to it, right? Well, there's I think the fly in the ointment, is that the city of Springfield, I'm sure, is not going to pay to hook us up. They're going to want us to pay to hook it up. The owner of our park did a quick study after phase one was done, and it would have cost him over $100,000. Most of the park owners can't afford that, so what do? When it comes time for the city to say, okay, we gave you a chance to hook up voluntarily, now we're requiring you to, between a rock and a hard place at that point.
What are city planners going to do about the homelessness that will occur? All our homeless services are greatly underserved. I don't see the city going to the state or the federal government doing any more than saying, in Eugene, it's already an emergency. And of course, I don't know what's worse than an emergency, but it's what you're talking about sounds like it's worse. And so Is there any kind of advocacy that can be done?
Oh, okay. Well, so I think the topic of homelessness generally is a very huge topic, and there are a lot of layers to the issue with why folks are homeless, what resources they do or do not have, and how we can sort of assemble existing resources to assist if they are willing to take assistance. As far as mobile home parks, to try and just keep it a little bit focused, because I think homelessness could be a separate topic entirely, the city has taken an advocacy role in the manufactured home park kind of world at a state level. For the last several years, we've really been looking around the state and regionally and saying, you know, this isn't just a Springfield or just a Glenwood issue. This is an aging population, an aging community issue throughout the state. You find manufactured home parks in multiple counties that are all dealing with aging systems that have not been maintained by property owners. They're not necessarily always running them like a standard business with ongoing maintenance or improvements or capital planning. So we went to the governor's office last year, and we asked for their resources to really help us lead a statewide effort that wraps up next week, actually, where we brought together affordable housing counselors, financial counselors, movers of structures, assessors and appraisers of structures, and local resource providers to say, if a park were to close for any reason, how could you most quickly respond and provide your services in a way that at least lines you up to the tenant shoulder to shoulder so they don't feel as alone as this likely will feel? It's not the exact fix, it's not a legislative fix, but what we were really going for is something that could be a true tool and not just a policy. And so that emergency rapid response plan will be something that will be require sort of the regional partners to sign on to and acknowledge that they will be a partner in rapidly responding if we have an issue. And we'll start talking with communities around the state and with our own leadership about how we make sure that plan is effectively in place. And a key part of it is to have conversations with the park owners so that they understand there's some responsibility on their part and ours to make sure that the services are safely provided to tenants.
Paul Thompson, a City Club member for some time. Our table was interested in having you discuss what kinds of protections for the mobile home parks beyond the Van Landingham bill were discussed during the process that you got the award for, and if they were discarded, why were they discarded, or if there were some merit in them, why were they not incorporated in the plan, and so on. So there had to be something beyond just what we're hearing today that was discussed and jettisoned for some reason in the plan.
I don't think it's quite as simple as that, partly because it is a planning process. And affordable housing is something that is discussed locally, regionally, and federally with multiple resources. The best we can do really in land use, because we can't bind private property owners to say, you know, you can or cannot sell your property, or you can or cannot request a plan amendment, was provide the ability for affordable housing and dense housing to occur within the refinement planning area. What we also knew from an economic standpoint was that part of what makes things affordable is when the community has the tools to step in and fund some of the infrastructure improvements. So we remove some of those costs off of the pro forma of the affordable housing entity or the housing developer, who maybe it's not legitimate, it's not standard HUD affordable housing, but it's going to be a lower rate monthly charged housing. It's that we move in and we start making investments in road improvements and you know, infrastructure like sanitary sewer or electric loops, using those urban renewal funds to sort of help subsidize that. So kind of in the planning world, we have to keep it really in the planning world, but just make it available for those affordable housing providers to use the plan.
Thank you. Sandra Bishop, City Club member. I know, Steve, your family has had this land on the river for generations. And I guess I'm interested in the larger picture here of what the vision is. And in country, you know, throughout the country, your, you know, cities are realizing they want to develop waterfront property. So there, to, for a specific question, there's one hotel been kind of thrown up in Glenwood, a very inexpensive, by inexpensive construction, I mean hotel. How does this fit into the larger plan? What's it going to look like? Is the plan for a convention center going forward? Has that been stalled or dropped completely? And what are we going to end up with percentage-wise of new construction? Is most of it going to be commercial? How much is going to be residential? Or is it mostly going to end up being commercial development? And over what period of time? Are we talking 50 years? Are we talking 10 years?
Well, and I'm sorry about my voice because it just isn't working very well. We were grateful that the hotel trusted Glenwood enough to set up in there, and it's worked well enough. He's got two more planned next to it. It's one in a Glenwood, and we hope it's a catalyst for others to come in there. At the other end, they've talked about the hotel convention center, and I haven't heard any more about it lately. I think they may be waiting for this roundabout project to be completed, because that's going to also be a catalyst and make that other end of Glenwood look much different, probably a lot more promising to anybody that wants to develop there. And I don't know what else to say, except I can't talk.
I'm Jerry Diethelm, City Club member, and Steve knows that it's been 6 or 8 years that I worked on the Glenwood Riverfront Plan, and we also looked at the beginnings of a Glenwood Refinement Plan for the rest of the city. And we've been talking mostly about sort of land use, and I remember the developer responses to the first Riverfront Plan were, this, you know, that they're not rivers, they're not making them anymore. This is really valuable property. But we're not coming here to invest unless you fix that road. Until you fix Franklin Boulevard, nothing is going to happen here. Nobody's going to come and put their money in it. Until you put a sewer in and sewer the things along the riverfront, you know, nothing's going to happen either. Well, the sewer is in, and there are some big plans for Franklin Boulevard, which we haven't discussed. I think it might be good for people to know what you're planning there. And the other thing that I worked on as a landscape architect as well as an architect was a lot of the open space along the river and the kind of the green space system that would actually, you know, develop over time in Glenwood. I think that's really crucial. You know, we don't have riverfront to waste around here, and so what the plans are for keeping that adequately public, I think, is another dimension that people would like to hear about. So if any of you wanted to talk about that.
You have about a minute to respond. We're saving your voice, so you have a minute to respond.
I stand on the fifth. We've been very aware of keeping the river open to the public. Willamette Greenway prohibits any development close to the river anyway. We have a bike path in the refinement plan, the entire length of Glenwood along the river. We have a lot of park area set aside that's going to be in the refinement plan. So any developer there is going to have to recognize that and plan around that. And well, she says park blocks, and that's the park areas. But
you go ahead. Franklin, to answer the question about Franklin, we will be moving into construction here in the next 6 months of the initial phase. The initial phase will make improvements so that we start to have bike facilities, adequate pedestrian facilities, transit facilities, moving through from the bridgehead to downtown Springfield, really for about a third of the Franklin distance before you get to the I-5 bridges. So it's a pretty important beginning of the improvement. The project really takes an area that doesn't have safe facilities on Franklin and starts to improve those, as well as creating some improved driveways into existing businesses and into future development areas.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Before we conclude, I have several announcements. First, let's give a big thanks to our speakers, Steve Moe, Courtney Griesel, Barry Summer, and to our first questioner, Lucy Vinnis, for bringing clarity and vision to today's topic, Glenwood Refinement Plan. Thanks also to Randy Prince, who coordinated the program, and thanks to our sponsors, Oregon Country Fair, Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics, AARP of Oregon, and KPFF Consulting Engineers. The City Club is seeking local businesses and organizations that want to grow while reaching an informed and curious audience. We can help you reach listeners who value civic involvement, desire to learn about current issues, and make thoughtful decisions. Show your leadership by supporting Open Inquiry and become a City Club sponsor. Due to a scheduling conflict, there will be no regular Friday meeting next week here at the Baker Center. However, we ask that you join us for the City Club's inaugural book chat at noon, Friday, September 16th, at the Davis Restaurant. We will begin discussing the common reading we adopted in solidarity with the incoming UO freshman, Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. We will exchange some ideas about the content and context of the book and figure out how we, including students, how we might use it to build connections with other members of the community, including students and faculty, in future events and City Club programs. This is a free meeting, open to all. If you haven't read the book, copies are available in several formats at the library and local bookstores. You can come to the event even if you haven't yet read the book, get some ideas on how to approach it. Refreshments will be available for purchase. No purchase is necessary to participate. The Davis is at 94 West Broadway, that's at Broadway and Olive. Additional information about today's topic, future programs, and opportunities for membership are available at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Cooperation and in conjunction with the required Eugene City Ordinance, I'll conclude the meeting by saying go Ducks.